Welcome, everyone, to the Beekeeper's Corner, Episode 7, Feed Me, Seymour. Hello, everyone. My name is Kevin England, and I want to welcome you once again to the BK Corner podcast. In this episode, I'll focus on the aspect of feeding the bees. Why to feed, what to feed, methods of feeding. I'll present you a basic primer on the topic and share some basic tips along the way. Are cell phones nuking the bees? A university study from India suggests some linkage, but I'm not convinced that this is the smoking gun for CCD. I'll talk about the results of the study and why we might want to keep an eye out on reports like this. What if bees are unwelcome guests? Maybe you have some neighbors that are not fond of your bee visitors. We'll share with you the USDA recommendations that you can talk to your neighbors about to keep bees out of their space. And last but not least, this episode's term of the day is allogrooming. Let's get to that local hive report. It's been 2 weeks since our last episode, and the truth of the matter is that we've not gone into the hives. That's not to say that we haven't been out to check on them. It's just that I'm trying to get back to one of the tenets that I don't want to be disturbing the bees every week, breaking open the hives, and unsealing them for the sake of routine inspections. While both hives were started this year, I know from the last set of inspections that they have plenty of bees and that there's honey and pollen across the frames. Given that knowledge, I've been resisting the temptation to go in only to discover that everything is the same. We have a feeder on hive number 2, and I've been feeding the colony a 1-to-1 sugar solution, and they've been taking it pretty well. I will say that I took the top cover off hive number 1 a few days ago, and I was going to peek in to the honey super to see if there's anything going on there, but the bees seemed really agitated, so I didn't even lift the inner cover. I put the top back on and walked away. I do plan on going out in the next few days and making a configuration change, and I want to check on a few things. We've had a few stretches of really warm weather here in New Jersey. It is summertime, after all. Given the hot and humid conditions, the bees have been bearding out on the front of our hives. We still have solid bottom boards on the hives, and I'm going to switch to our screen bottom boards. I figure the screen bottom boards will give them more ventilation and can also come in handy if we see Varroa that needs to be treated and decide to do the powdered sugar on one of the hives like we discussed in episode number 6. Secondly, the first hive, as mentioned, has a honey super on it still. I was hoping to get the last vestiges of spring and maybe get some nectar in there, but not sure that they really did anything with it. If they're not storing honey on there, I might pull the super off after checking the health of the colony. The last time I looked, the population was great, and there were plenty of honey and pollen stores in the hive. If we find that the conditions have changed, then I would consider putting a top feeder back on to make sure that they maintain a good cache of bees by stimulating the hive to grow. The other aspect to that is, if you do put a honey super or you do put a feeder on top, you don't want a honey super because then they would load the honey super with sugar water. Of course, now is the time to manage Varroa. Let me say that again. It is imperative that the bees be managed right now for Varroa, as they will begin to make their winter bees and they need to be kept in top health. Colony survival over winter depends on what we do right now with our hives. I have some drone brood frames in hive number 1, and I want to see if the comb is fully built out. I went against one of the tenets that you need to feed bees for them to build out comb, but the last time I looked, they were doing some construction on those frames, and now I want to see if they've fully populated it with brood. If that is the case, then we want to make sure that Varroa is not present. Haven't seen any Varroa this year, but if I don't check the drone brood frames, I'll risk an opposite effect of putting in drone comb to cull Varroa, but creating an environment to breed them. Suffice it to say that I've got to go in and see what is in there. Makes me wonder, do I have enough room in the freezer to freeze those frames if the Varroa is present? I'll have to talk Sharon into letting me put those in the freezer. I'll have to stop buying veal chops or whatever is in there. Of course, if varroa are present, a treatment is warranted, so you can see there's a lot on my mind about the objectives of getting through fall and winter and keeping the colonies in good shape when heading into fall. We'll update you on what we find in the next episode, but that's enough for right now. When we come back, it's time to review the basics of feeding bees.
Took you to a place where there's only us two. Remember once I took you to a place where there's only me and you. But I miss you, sweet darling. I wish you'd meet me there too. Remember once I took you to a place where there's only us two. When I miss you, sweet darling, I want to see you there.
If you go online and participate in any beekeeping forum, or you stand around long enough at a beekeeping meeting, and one of the questions that inevitably comes up are you feeding your bees? What are you feeding your bees? How are you feeding your bees? There's a whole industry and best practice around feeding bees, and in one respect, as a simple task, it's something that as a beekeeper doesn't seem that complicated, but you know what? I said best practice, and that's what I always wanted to know. I looked through various resources on the topic and collected what I would call a basic guide on the ins and outs of feeding. Let's start with one of the most basic questions about the activity. Why feed bees in the first place? Several reasons exist to feed the bees. Feed them when stores are short in the springtime. The USDA indicates a colony being prepared for winter in the north should have about 6 combs containing large areas of stored pollen. Colonies in the southern and southwestern regions may not require as much pollen because the pollen sources that periodically become available to them in those climates. Colonies in all regions of the United States should have at least 60 to 90 pounds of honey in the fall, though. Another reason to feed them? To stimulate the queen to lay. Feeding stimulates brood production and wax production. Think about this. The bees can jump right into building out comb if that's an objective of the beekeeper instead of burning cycles in the spring seeking pollen and nectar. Feed them when you're planning on building up a colony for a split. Feed them to sustain brood rearing and colony development during inclement weather. Feed them when the primary food source is a monoculture crop. I shared in our last episode that they just plowed under the field and used Roundup to kill all the weeds around the field, and then they planted corn next door. If you're in a monoculture area, and while that's not necessarily the case in my area, it is an example, bees need a varied diet. Just like us, their diet requires a range of vitamins, minerals, proteins, and fats for proper nutrition. Ideally, these are sourced from a variety of plants, and feeding should be a stopgap for hives that are being used for single-source pollination. Ideally, the quicker you can get them to a diverse food source, the better. So then the next question is, when is the best or desirable times to feed your bees? You can look at this from two aspects. I start with the first one, period of year. Most people will tell you you feed in the spring if stores are low, and you want to feed in the spring after the nectar flow has ceased, especially if you're looking at a dry summer or a long stretch where the bees are not going to be able to get to it. As noted earlier, you want to feed if there's any need for your colony to build out comb. Time of the day versus period of the year is another aspect of when is the desirable time. If robbing is a concern, feed your bees at twilight or early in the morning before foraging begins. Couple notes about that. Do be careful as you're going into the hive and everyone's home. At that time of day when they're not out, you're going to find a full population. Don't be rolling your queen or doing something like that. If your feeding is resulting in robbing, consider the use of a hive entrance reducer until the situation is under control. Here's a little sidebar. By the way, if you're going out and a flashlight is needed, better watch out for the guard bees. Use a flashlight at night is like providing a sting this way sign to the bees. One trick is that you go out at night, use a red filter on your light, or torch as they say in England. The bees can't identify the red spectrum. Ever wonder why hummingbird feeders are red? Use a red filter and this will help to mask you. Okay, so we got two things out of the way. Why feed the bees in the first place and when is the best or desirable time to feed? How about what do you feed them? First and foremost, nectar is the food for bees. If you look at the pink pages online, listen to a previous episode and you'll know what that means. That's what the answer is. Nectar is the food for bees. Most would probably have guessed honey, but the reality is honey is a stored food for winter use. Next to nectar, plain table sugar is probably best. Some beekeepers like to use high fructose corn syrup, or HFCS as it's often referred to. HFCS comes as syrup and it's usually inexpensive. The problem with this product is that high fructose corn syrup can be toxic to the bees based on the kind of sugars it contains, especially if it's allowed to be heated. A study that is in progress by the USDA Agricultural Research Services report that, quote, preliminary caged bee studies indicate that HFCS fed undiluted, with water always present, was detrimental to bees when compared to sucrose syrup. Over 50% of the bees were dead by the 17th day compared to 38% dead of bees fed on sucrose. The USDA is investigating the impact of HMF, a toxic byproduct of HFCS, once it's heated or stored in a warm environment. Bottom line is, if you're going to use high fructose corn syrup, you can't let it heat up. It's going to create this toxic byproduct that's going to kill your bees. Incidentally, there are many resources on the web where beekeepers are feeding HCFS, so I suppose there are no absolutes. They profess that it has to be very high quality, and many of them are cutting it with water. To each his own, I suppose. If you ask my opinion, basic table sugar is simple, it's easy, it's the way to go. Why would you bother with it? Typically, commercial beekeepers who use huge volumes and don't want to deal with the mix might consider HFCS, but for the backyard beekeeper, table sugar is probably the best way to go. So what about pollen patties? I found a USDA publication. It's from 1978, but I'm assuming it still holds true. It indicates that, quote, proteins of a precise quality and definite amino acid compositions are required for optimum growth of young adult bees and for the development of brood food producing, I'm going to kill this one, hypopharyngeal glands of nurse worker bees. If nurse bees do not get pollen or some other appropriate protein source, their brood food gland secretions are not adequate for support of normal growth and development of the larvae and egg production of the queen, end quote. Translation is, bees need protein and it's provided by nature, and they address the question of why honeybees may need supplemental foods. A quote, supplemental foods are fed to honeybees to supply the nutritive requirements of colonies in area and at times when natural food sources, pollen, nectar, or honey, are inadequate or not available. The brood-rearing activity and nutritional state of the colony, the quantity and quality of the incoming pollen and nectar, and the food reserves in the hive will determine whether the bees need supplemental foods, end quote. So the USDA confirms what you probably already know. If there's not a source of pollen, nectar, or honey, feed your bees, consider pollen patties, consider sugar, and make sure you take care that they get the food stores that they need in order to keep the hive thriving. Incidentally, one of the more important things that was touched upon in the last episode of this podcast was that bees require a water source. Can't forget that. Water is an essential requirement for bees, and it can adversely affect the health of your colony if water is not readily available. Consider a water feature, maybe a pan with water and something floating in it, or even a pond or a kiddie pool nearby makes sense if you don't have something readily available and you're in a dry spell. In some respects, it's probably not a stretch to say that bees have more resources to food in their environment than they do to water, depending on where you live. Typically, there's usually some sort of food source nearby, but water, that can be a different story. So we talked about what you do feed them, what don't you feed them, and why. Carob syrup, brown sugar, powdered sugar, molasses, and especially honey that comes from the grocery store and is processed are not good for bee consumption. Except for plain sugar, these products contain starches and or other sugars that are not totally digestible by the bees and could cause problems. Most notably, a lot of websites talk about dysentery. It should be said that there's also a risk to feeding them honey frames from unknown sources. Let's be hygienic out there. What's the best method to feed? It's a good topic. There are a ton of different feeder configurations out there. Personal preference and conditions often dictate what's best to use at any given time. For example, external feeders may be convenient for beekeepers, but too far from the center of the hive body when conditions are cold and bees may not want to make the trip. Boardman feeders, the upside-down mason jars placed at a hive entrance, are called out in beekeeping circles for one common bad trait, and that is they induce robbing right at the front entrance of the hive. Many beekeepers like the division board feeders. These frame-shaped feeders go inside a hive, hold a reasonable amount of sugar water, and are pretty easy to work with. Bees have easy access due to the proximity of the brood, but they do require you to open the hive to load. I've mentioned recently that I don't particularly like cracking into the hive all the time because you're opening the hive and breaking all the propolis that they use to seal it, and they have to go back to work and use their resources for that, so to each his own as to whether you want to use an internal feeder. Hive top feeders of all shapes and sizes are also available. I'll be generic and say that a box that holds liquid with some form of ingress is a hive top feeder. As you know from previous episodes, we use these successfully on our own hives. Other methods, remember I'm being generic here, are slit Ziploc bags. Take a razor and slit them. The water seeps out and the bees come and get them. Upside down jars, friction top pail feeders, and so on. There's plenty of information on the web for the various methods, and again, do consider that if it's cold outside, bees may not travel far for the food that you provide them. Incidentally, some use shims in between the hive boxes or under top covers to place pollen patties, fondant, or other sources of food, including just plain old dry table sugar. These shims often have some sort of trapdoor built into the side, and they slide food in while keeping the cold out. Bees work hard to stay warm, and cranking open a hive to feed is a poor plan. Dry sugar is often a preferred method when it's cold outside. Do note that sometimes the bees will see it as debris and carry it out, but other times they'll take it just fine. It is important to remember that they need some sort of water source in order to convert that dry sugar into a syrup. If you find yourself in a situation where you want to keep feeding when the temperatures are heading down, do consider deploying any possible extra frames of honey that you have at your disposal. It is the winter fuel of bees, after all. A couple miscellaneous feeding topics to leave you with before we close out this segment. When feeding bees, be studious about the way you go about it. Use care not to overfill your feeders or spill solution around the hive or on the bees. Spilling around the hive could induce robbing, and bees may not recover when covered in a thick syrup. Be sure that your covers are snug. You don't want bees entering in ways that they shouldn't. And one last thing to care for is to remove drowned bees from the solution as you find them. Dead bees can taint the solution enough that bees will not take the syrup. Also, dead bees can serve as a source of protein, and that can stimulate small hive beetle reproduction. I mentioned a second ago that bees won't take the syrup if the syrup is tainted. Truth of the matter is, sometimes bees just won't take the syrup, and that's the way it's going to be. It may mean that they don't need the syrup. It may mean that not enough of them have found the syrup. A recent post by a knowledgeable beekeeper in our Northwest Beekeepers Forum indicated that his opinion was that bees do not have a signal to explain that, by the way, there's food upstairs. Typically, a bee dance or a signal given to other bees explains where to go in proximity of the hive to go externally to get it, and there is no thing for, hey, there's a huge vat of food upstairs. Bees discover one by one, and there's no way for them to communicate that the mother load is up above in a top hive feeder. Whatever the case may be, typically what you'll find is that sometimes you'll feed bees, at least in our case I've seen this, and it'll be on there for days and days and they won't take it, and then the next thing you know, you come back in 2 days and it's completely gone. You refill it, and in 2 days, it's completely gone. You refill it, and in a day, it's gone. Then you refill it, and they don't take it at all. Go figure. You know, if we knew how all these bees things worked, I guess we'd all be expert beekeepers. But, you know, sometimes you feed them, and they just don't take it. Do not distress over this. Just make sure that the syrup you provide is fresh and that there aren't dead bees in it. And if in doubt, just swap the sugar out and give them something fresh to work with. We hope you like this primer on feeding, and if you have any suggestions, comments, thoughts about how you do it, send us a note. Our website is www.bkcorner.org, and we could be reached at kevin@bkcorner.org. That's it for this segment. We'll be right back after this short break.
To my baby, asking her to come on home. Sent a letter to my baby, begging her to come on home. Didn't get a letter back, I guess she don't write me no more. Sent a message to my baby, telling her I missed her so. Send a message to my baby, telling her I missed her so.
Is there a link between the 30% decline in bee populations in the U.S. and cell phones? I was of the impression that this notion had been debunked long ago. Still, a recent media report piqued my interest and provided something that I always wondered. What is it exactly that cell phones do to bees? The study I came across centered upon some research from the Punjab University in India. In this study, researchers attached a cell phone to the exterior of a hive and powered it up for 15 minutes twice a day for 3 months. The impact to the hives was that the bees stopped making honey, there was a 50% decrease in egg production, and the population of the hive went down. CNN coverage of this study included an interview with a biologist who said maybe the loss of bees was from the radiation damage. Cell phone radiation, he surmised, could do harm to a bee by doing harm to a pigment found in the eyes of the bees. The pigment is called cryptochrome, and it gives bees the potential to see the direction of the Earth's magnetic field. Research on the topic seemed to indicate that bees might be able to see an alternate color or visual artifact that displays in their vision and represents the magnetic indicator. The point of this wasn't to get into a biology lesson, so I won't go any further on that aspect of it. Concerning the article, there are several counterpoints to that particular study that have appeared since this report surfaced, most of them challenge its approach and methods. I must say that anything that could result in bees not coming back to the hive, though, interests me. I'm not sure strapping a cell phone to the outside of a hive has any relevance to the exposure from the cell phone systems at large, but I did read a conclusion from the radiationresearch.org website that says, and I quote, "Like birds, bees may also find electromagnetic fields disturbing and choose to leave the area. Scientists who put DECT cordless phone base stations, cheap sources of modulated microwaves, next to their beehives found that they made bees behave abnormally and were less likely to return to the hive. Based on this observation, beekeepers would be well advised to switch off their cell phones when visiting their hives. Even when not in use, cell phones periodically emit bursts of radiation at full power so the phone company can keep track of where you are." End quote. So maybe this Punjab study is not the magic bullet for colony collapse disorder and the reasons that the bees are dying, but it is an interesting outcome, and if it lets us stop and pause for a moment to think about the potential options of why our bees are dying, I think it's worth the time to take a look at these. A friend once told me about this old adage that if 78% of gangsters drink milk, does that mean milk is the reason gangsters are gangsters? You know, I say, if you strap a cell phone to the side of a hive, I'm not exactly sure what that proves, but I do believe that we as humans and the insects and animals around us are being affected by the radiation that's bombarding us every day. Maybe it's a conspiracy theory or whatever, but a beekeeper recently told me, as close as 2 months ago, about how he had to move his set of bees because they were underneath high tension wires and the bees were not finding their way back and acting erratically, and it wasn't until he moved them to an alternate location on a farm that he was pollinating that the bees started to behave properly again. So the jury is out, but I say let's keep our eyes and minds open to all possibilities. It is summertime, and for many that means enjoyable hours spent poolside in the backyard. The other day, Sharon and I were having a discussion about where our bees go for water, and we both surmised that our bees are probably going to our neighbors' pools, given the tendency for flight away from our property. That got me to thinking. Our neighbors know we have bees, and they are bee-friendly people, so they probably tolerate an occasional bee at their water source, but what if you're not so fortunate? The USDA had some recommendations on their website about this topic, and you might be surprised at the answer. Here is the advice they offer to keep bees away from your pools. When you first notice bees around your pool, mix a quarter cup of dish soap to a quarter of water, and fill an empty sprayer bottle with it. Using the soapy mixture, spray any bees that are at your pool. This soapy mixture will kill the bees quickly and without harmful pesticide residues. Do this every time you see a bee at a water source. You want to keep bee free. This will kill those foragers who are telling others in the colony where your swimming pool is located. Eventually, those foragers who are not returning to the colony will have died. Other foragers will find a different source of water, so do not worry that you're harming the colony. You are only eliminating a few individuals. The premise behind this is if you negate the scout bee, then word never gets back to the hive of the water source. Sound logic, and it means the extermination of a few bees. If your neighbors are killing off visitors anyway, this might be something that you might want to consider sharing if the problem comes up in conversation. If that doesn't sit well with you, you can at least offer a few other suggestions. For water sources like bird baths or pet water, the suggestion is to mix 2 tablespoons of vinegar per gallon of water. Tubs and pools could be covered when not in use, and leaky faucets and irrigation systems should also be managed if people are worried about bees arriving. Me personally, I'd slip in this suggestion. Ask them to build a water source specifically for your bees. Something in between their pool and your hives. If beekeepers ruled the world, everyone's lawns would have dandelions and water sources would be prevalent. Don't forget that a lot of people complain that bees come in and take over their hummingbird feeders. You can go on the web and purchase your neighbor a nice gift, which is a hummingbird feeder made specifically to keep bees out. Hopefully you find that advice useful and can share that with your neighbors if problems arise with your bees making unwelcome visits. Let's jump with both feet right into the term of the day. The term of this episode is allogrooming. The common definition refers to animal grooming, but it applies to bees too. The definition: allogrooming is grooming performed by one animal upon another animal of the same species. Opposed to autogrooming, which is an animal that grooms itself, allogrooming behavior is a means of achieving hygiene and good health in that animal helps another animal to clean itself, and it is also a form of social bond and trust between them. In beekeeping, one bee invokes allogrooming by performing a grooming dance. I have to insert dance, 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 dance. What's ringing down? No, sorry, it just came to mind. The grooming dance is an invitation dance or shaking dance performed by honeybees to initiate allogrooming. It was first reported in 1945 by a biologist by the name of Michaela Haydack. It was published in the American Bee Journal, if you're interested, volume 85, page 316 and 317. Interestingly enough, it's one of the bees' arsenal to combat mite infestation and tracheal mites especially, and an increase in the frequency of the grooming dance has been observed among the bees of mite-infested colonies. Beekeepers have been seeking out bees that do auto- and allogrooming as a hygienic practice because they tend to be mite-resistant. There's an interesting article in a recent Bee Culture magazine about grooming. I believe it's a June issue. And it concerns allogrooming versus autogrooming and the effectiveness for our bee hygiene. What they're saying is bees that autogroom, especially when they use their middle legs and clean their thorax, are really good at cleaning off the tracheal mites. And it's an effective trait that you're looking for in your bees. We'll look to see if we can provide a link for that in the show notes here. But that is today's episode, Term of the Day, allogrooming. Hopefully you've not heard that, and that's a new one for you. So I wanted to share some thoughts with you about how the podcast is going and closing comments right up after this. Stay with us, won't you?
What you're trying to do, get away from me, I'm avoiding you. I don't know what you're trying to say, same thing you're saying as yesterday. We want the truth, we're sick of your lies, your excuses and false alibis. We've been down this road before, get out of the way, yeah, I'm closing the door.
I hope you liked what we brought to the podcast in this episode, and will state for the record that I perceive the world in this way when producing these episodes. I'm a beekeeper, I could say that. I keep bees and know enough to be dangerous. I liken it to the food TV network show How to Boil Water, where I'm a novice and somebody's teaching me. I don't per se have that direct mentor, but I'm using the web and my friends as beekeepers to keep me posted. Still, sometimes I wonder if the professional beekeepers think that we novices do more harm than good to the industry, but I guess that's a topic for another show. I suppose that what I do here is doing my part, but I'm under no illusions that what I present in these episodes is complete and comprehensive. So I'll say to you, the listener, maybe my job here is to pique your interest in a topic, and I do hope that you go off and do some additional research if I've gotten your interest up. Is that even English? Maybe I'll expose you to something you didn't know, or maybe I'll say something wrong and you'll do me the courtesy of politely guiding me in my ways. What I have learned in these few episodes is that each one is like writing a paper. There's research and grammar and continuity and production putting these together, and somewhere in the layers I know that I'm learning about beekeeping through the research and interactions with each and every topic. I found some valuable resources on the web, and in this episode you heard me refer to the USDA information on several occasions, and now I have a few reasonable, trustworthy resources to review when questions come up. The funny thing is about beekeeping is you'll find the gamut of information. You'll find people who offer one-liners and sage advice, and you'll find these periodicals that are so technical that even an educated person would struggle to keep up what the heck they're talking about. I don't know, I guess I'll continue to look through different resources and find what I can find, but as this podcast matures, I'm assuming I'll move in the direction of providing some listener feedback, email, and things like that. I do think, though, that the fundamental premise to document and learn on the journey for beekeeping knowledge is still intact, so we're in a good place. Thanks for letting me share here. Time to call it a day for this episode and get to work on the next one. Couple of music notes for today. The sounds were certainly bluesy-esque. Hair Club for Men started us off with Going to That Place. Great name for a band. Dave Ski followed up with a backcountry blues riff, The Letter. Jerry Tinkleberg, unfortunate name, brought us Miss You from the album Clear Music from a Distorted Window. A little midlife crisis music, not sure if the tune, looks like it was clipped from a live recording. And our exit music that you're listening to is Freddie with a part from the album Things You Never Thought I'd Say. The county fair starts next week, and an upcoming fall meeting is approaching for the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association. So still several things to report on for the beekeeping season. See you next time, and thanks for listening to the Beekeeper's Corner.
take you apart now. Won't play with your heart now. I wanna see all the pieces from which you are. I just wanna see if it's broken. If the words that I've spoken put it back the right way. But I don't think that I should stay tonight. I don't think that I should stay tonight. I don't.